It's the Burt Cohen Show. Dreams made real. History is what happens to us, and the past isn't the past, it's here now. Some people's dreams become other people's nightmares, and we are a product of our history. It's some fun stuff. Our recent history is pretty darn amazing, aside from our long ago history, but Bill Clinton was president not that long ago. What is his legacy? What is his history? What people remember about presidents is usually even less than a full soundbite. It's a brief snapshot. Of course, we don't yet know what Obama's legacy will be, but the Bush and Reagan legacies are pretty clear, transforming America largely from a republic to a plutocracy, some new wars, and in Bush's case, a remarkably unimpressive intellect. But the legacy of Bill Clinton, as our guest, Dr. Stephen Jonas, has written, quote, doesn't seem to garner much attention. However, on the domestic side, it has been, over the long term, just as damaging to the nation as has been George W. Bush's on the foreign side, end quote. So, as his wife Hillary may be gearing up to run for president herself, amazingly enough, as a Democrat, allegedly, it is indeed appropriate to take a fresh look at the first Clinton presidency, as no doubt he would be a big player in her campaign and presidency were that to happen. Well, our guest today is Dr. Stephen Jonas, Professor Emeritus of Preventive Medicine at Stony Brook University and author, co-author of over 30 books, in addition to being a columnist for BuzzFlash at Truthout. He's the editorial director of and contributing author to The Political Junkies for Progressive Democracy. His latest book, which I'm looking forward to reading, is The 15% Solution, How the Republican Religious Right Took Control of the United States, 1981 to 2022, a futuristic novel. Well, thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Stephen Jonas.
Thanks so much, Mr. Cohen, and thanks for that very, very generous introduction.
Ah, well, it's going to be fun. You know, every presidential term leaves a mark on who we are as Americans and on the very identity of what America is, both domestically and in terms of foreign relations. In no particular order, let's take a look at the ways the Clinton presidency changed America. Let's start with those annoying and ubiquitous TV commercials that we are flooded with today for prescription drugs. Such things never used to be allowed on TV, you know, urging us consumers, as opposed to just citizens, to ask our doctor, you know, trying to lead our doctor into supplying some profits for the pharmaceutical industry. How did these come about, and what have they done to America, specifically as a drug culture, and what did Bill Clinton have to do with this rather radical change?
Yeah. If I could, let me just, you know, back up a little bit and perhaps set a stage here for what we're going to talk about. In terms of in the content of the column that I published on BuzzFlash that you so kindly read and then so kindly called me about, I think that the biggest feature, if we may say so, of Bill Clinton is that somehow this man has an aura of liberalism.
He is
labeled as a Democrat. He was the chairman of something called the Democratic Leadership Council, which actually led the Democratic Party, started leading the Democratic Party under his chairmanship to its present right-wing position back in the 1980s. But nevertheless, Bill Clinton is generally seen as a liberal part of this is the way he was treated by the Republican Party during his presidency from 1993 to 2001. What a lot of people don't realize is that the Republican Party engaged in the same kind of concerted attack on Clinton to attempt to prevent him from doing just about anything he wanted to do that was at all liberal or progressive, perish the word, you know, leading up, of course, to the impeachment. It's very funny to me. I do, I must admit that I, on occasion, watch Morning Joe, and it's really very amusing to see the way Joe Scarborough refers to Bill Clinton, and with a lot of admiration when Scarborough was part of that Gingrich group in the Congress that you know, that led the attack on Clinton. So one of the reasons I wrote this column was to contrast the reality of the Clinton presidency with the aura that Clinton himself still manages to project, and the aura that was cast upon him by his opponents, who, while they may speak kindly about him now, certainly spoke with about him in anything but kindly terms during his presidency. I think it's very interesting that you pick the matter of prescription drug advertising for the first one. Certainly not at the top of the list of negatives, but symbolic of what Clinton did and what the Democratic Leadership Council-led Democratic Party did during his presidency and is still doing in the Congress and with the current president. We're here to discuss Clinton, not Obama.
Right.
It is. I don't think there's any other country in the world that permits the public advertising of prescription medications to the general public. It is the there's a reason why prescription medication, and I'm a physician, there's a reason why prescription medications are under prescription. And that is because while they can do wondrous things, they can also have wondrous side effects. Not so wondrous side effects. Prescription medications taken two or more at the same time can have up to disastrous effects. It's very interesting to note that the content of most of the, in fact, every ad for every pharmaceutical I've ever seen, and as a physician, I follow them, although, you know, the ones for Cialis and Viagra are just repeated over and over again. Mainly, they're used now to protect, attempt to protect the pharmaceutical companies against suit because they list all of the complications. Nevertheless, it was Clinton who permitted this, yet why? Because the pharmaceutical companies wanted it. They wanted to, certainly the drugs that are advertised by the pharmaceutical companies are the highly profitable ones, and they wanted to influence patients and potential patients to put pressure on their doctors to prescribe these medications for the profits of the pharmaceutical companies. You will not find advertisements for medications that are not profitable.
And as you mentioned, in your knowledge, no other country does that. It's amazing to me how, you know, and to me, I get a little more than a little spooked by some of the, you know, you got to be careful. It could cause this and that, you know, cause you to go blind or whatever, or could kill you. But they still want to drive people to that. What does that say about the political power and the change of it? I mean, it was never allowed before Clinton.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has, you know, over decades has become ever more powerful. They have produced some, certainly they produce some medications which do a lot of good. At the same time, they produce medications which produce a lot of profits for them. It's very interesting. I don't know whether this is still the case, but I know several decades ago when I was looking at this stuff, two of the most profitable industries in the United States probably does not apply anymore to the tobacco industry. But at that time, about 20, 25 years ago, two of the most profitable industries in the United States were the tobacco industry, which makes people sick.
Yeah, it kills people.
And the pharmaceutical industry, which attempts to cure them.
Yeah. Well, there's profit either way, going in or
that, you know, that this is a symbol of what Bill Clinton really stood for. And that is promoting at the basis various aspects of capitalism and capitalist profits.
Well, let's take a look at, you know, somehow how he can be described as a liberal. It amazes me, really. But, you know, people actually call our current president, Barack Obama, a liberal, which is like, what? Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I mean, yep. They have no idea what it means. Talk a little bit about the Democratic Leadership Council and its legacy on the Democratic Party that we have today.
In my view, well, the Democratic Leadership Council made no bones of that it wanted to move the Democratic Party to the right, just like a New Labor under Tony Blair. I'm sorry, Tony Blair. I always mispronounce that name.
Yeah, okay.
You know, the so-called New Labor in Great Britain. To me, symbolically, it began on the night of the nomination of George McGovern in 1972. I was a strong supporter of George McGovern.
As was I.
Yes, I'm sure you were. And I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning Eastern time to watch George's acceptance speech. George was a wonderful man. He later became something of a friend of mine. He wrote a foreword to my first political book. Just a wonderful man.
Yes.
I wrote an appreciation of George McGovern after he passed away fairly recently.
Yeah.
What, among other things, what many people don't know about George McGovern, and George McGovern would never tell you, and should have in the 1972 campaign. In World War II, he was a pilot.
Yes.
B-24 pilot, and the B-24s, the B-24 heavy bomber was called the Flying Coffin. And the reason it was called the Flying Coffin is that if the B-24 were hit either by enemy aircraft or by anti-aircraft guns, it was a very difficult plane to get out of, to escape from.
Yikes.
George McGovern flew B-24s from a base in Italy.
Yep.
As I'm sure you know, but many of our listeners may not know, there was a limit on 25 missions for air crews. If a U.S. air crew survived 25 missions, they were taken off the planes and sent home. George McGovern completed his 25 missions and volunteered for another 10.
Oh my.
Yeah, that was George McGovern.
Yes. He was a friend of mine, too, I'm proud to say.
One of the mistakes was that he didn't get out there and hammer away at Richard Nixon, who spent the war in a desk at a back area somewhere in the Central Pacific. Never came close to action. That's what Richard Nixon, the war hawk, did during World War II.
Mm-hmm. Desk jockey.
But anyway...
So how did that...
And George made many mistakes in terms of his political management.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was that on the night of his nomination, you know, he was nominated by a coalition of many, many different interest groups, and they all demanded a place on the podium to give a speech on the night of his nomination. And what the McGovern people should have done was to say, great, everybody's going to get up here after I give my speech at 10 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, that was...
And he didn't. He was bent over backwards to be polite, and he ended up speaking at 2 o'clock in the morning.
So nobody could see it.
Nobody could see it, but what you could see, and, you know, a few of us stayed up. I stayed up to watch, and I see the vision is in my mind's eye. In a balcony of wherever the convention was held, not on the stage, there were Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator from Boeing, Hubert Humphrey, who had been a left-winger in the Democratic Party when he led the first civil rights demonstration at a national convention in 1948,
yeah,
but had become center-right.
Oh, yeah.
And several of the, I forget the names now, several of the other leading center-right Democratic senators standing there glaring down at George McGovern with their arms folded. And the symbolism was just overwhelming. And as I say, this occurred, you know, in 1972. I still remember it. I could see it in my mind's eye, Bert, you know, as we talk. And that's where it started, that there was this powerful group of Democratic senators and other Democratic leaders, certainly supported by industry. I mean, you know, like like Scoop Jackson, who said that if we're going to get back to power, we have to move right, and that's when it started. And then after the Carter loss and then the Mondale loss to Reagan, that's when the Democratic Leadership Council organized, and it was led primarily by South and Southwestern Democrats. The two most prominent were Bill Clinton and Al Gore. And Al Gore was very... Al Gore, back in those days, Al Gore was to the right of Bill Clinton.
Hmm.
Yeah. And they then dominated the Democratic Party through the Clinton presidency and well into the 21st century. They formally dissolved several years ago after the Obama election. But certainly their people still exist, personified by Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Interesting. And there's certainly a divide in the Democratic Party today. And my sense is the traditional Democrats, the progressives, the populists, the people who stand for tradition in the Democratic Party are gaining power. They've been there's been revulsion at the move to the right. And a lot of this was led and put in place by Bill Clinton, who, again, went along with the plutocratization of America, shall we say.
Well, he went along with it. And, you know, what I said in this column, I don't think that Clinton just went along with it. You know, I think Clinton was a leader. He pushed the worst thing that happened. Well, there was, you can't say the worst.
Right.
There were, you know, there was a list of changes that were made in policy in the during the Clinton presidency that affected the economy that were totally consistent with what was started under Ronald Reagan. Totally consistent with Reaganomics, with which we are dealing now and getting worse and worse. And the two of them were NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Association, and Ross Perot, you know, certainly kooky to a certain extent, said if NAFTA is enacted, you're going to hear a very strong whooshing sound of jobs moving south of the border.
And
whoosh,
there it went.
But you know, worse than that, for the American economy and for the American workers, and we now are dealing with the deindustrialization of the United States and falling wages, declining living standards, was of course the World Trade Organization, the opening up of the possibility of major movement of American capital to China and other low-wage countries. And most people don't understand that this was facilitated very simply. When you eliminated or vastly lowered tariffs on goods coming from foreign countries in the World Trade Organization list, which was very long, you then made it possible for U.S. capitalists to ship their capital abroad and manufacture goods abroad for importation into the United States without having to pay any tariffs. So what happened was, and the American people didn't realize, you know, when Walmart exploded and Target exploded with all kinds of very attractive, well-made, inexpensive goods that they could buy, what the American people didn't realize that what they were doing is they were trading their jobs and their futures and their children's and grandchildren's futures for cheap goods in Walmart.
If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Dr. Stephen Jonas, author of a new book, The 15% Solution, How the Republican Religious Right Took Control of the U.S. 1981 to 2022, a futuristic novel. We're talking about the legacy of Bill Clinton, how today's economy and so much of the shape of America, the identity of America today, things that many of us don't like, are thanks to Bill Clinton, like shipping jobs overseas. And, you know, a lot of us have blamed Republicans for this, but making it easy to shift jobs overseas. There was NAFTA, as you mentioned, Dr. Jonas, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I wonder about, you know, what this says, not just about America, but about the Democratic Party. It seems that, you know, the traditional political muscle of the unions was overpowered on this. They've, you know, Democratic opponents always say, oh, it's the unions, the bad unions. Where were the players in getting NAFTA passed?
Well, let me comment on that, because
sure.
That the destruction of trade unionism in the United States goes way back beyond Bill Clinton.
And oh, yeah.
That's one thing we can't really blame Clinton for. I'd like to comment on that briefly.
Sure.
I'd also like to say that the other major economic policy that Clinton pushed through was with which we are still dealing and we will probably deal with forever, was the repeal of what was called the Glass-Steagall.
Oh, yes. I wasn't going to forget that.
Which was an act passed in 1934. It was one of the gems of the New Deal. And it said that banks could either be commercial banks, that is, you know, offering public checking and savings accounts and loans for mortgages and so on and so forth, or they could be investment banks. And different rules governed the commercial banks and the investment banks, different rules in relation to whose money they could invest if they were investment banks, and what kind of reserves that they need to have against the rainy day funds for banks for the commercial banks. And Clinton, whether he told Steve Summers to do it or Steve Summers suggested that this be done, whatever, they got together and they got the repeal of Glass-Steagall through the Congress. And 2008 happened precisely because banks were no longer separated. They no longer had to have the kinds of reserves, the kinds of banks that you and I deal with, didn't have to have the kinds of reserves, and the investment banks using other people's money, and then these very complicated. I remember reading something about derivatives, where an expert in derivatives, was being interviewed for a column, I guess in the Times, and at one point said, I don't really fully understand these things.
Well, that's the thing. Nobody really did.
I think the point that you made about the trade union movement, and that's something I didn't deal with in here, because one thing that Clinton didn't do, did a lot of right-wing things, he did not help to, continue the charge against the trade union movement, but the...
How did it happen?
It's very interesting, and I've written on this elsewhere. First of all, the major industrialized countries, the United States traditionally had the lowest trade union membership, about one-third of American workers were unionized at the height of the power of the trade union movement in the 1950s. Compared to countries like Great Britain, France, Germany, one of the reasons for the fascist takeover in Germany was that the trade union movement was so powerful there. the trade union movement was very, very powerful. Unfortunately, it was bitterly split between the Communist Party and the Socialist Party unions, and that made it an easy target for the fascists, but that's another story. But of the major countries in the world, excluding the fascists, the countries that became fascist, the United States was the last to legalize collective bargaining. Collective bargaining by labor unions was not legal in this country until the passage of the Wagner Act in 1938. Things were put on hold during the Second World War, but immediately after the Second World War, when the Republicans took the Congress in 1946, they passed a law called the Taft-Hartley Act.
Right.
Which did a number of things, put a number of restrictions on trade unions. It prohibited communists, members of the Communist Party, from the leadership of trade unions. And the reason they did that is that several of the most powerful unions in the country, namely particularly the United Auto Workers and the United Electrical Workers, were led by communists. A lot of people don't know that at one time Walter Reuther was a member of the Communist Party. And the most effective organizing during the Depression was done by members of the Communist Party. And I knew some of them, people who worked on the street and organizing labor in the industrial, the what were called the industrial unions. And as a small boy, I knew some of these people. They're really great people. So it prohibited them. It also paved the way for the so-called right-to-work laws in states, which said that you could not have closed shops, you could not have union shops, you couldn't even have agency shops, which means something which is under attack again now, where you didn't have to belong to the union, but you had to pay the dues.
Right. Well, they're trying to.
So the American the labor movement was under attack from the time of the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act. President Truman, to his credit, vetoed the Taft-Hartley Act, but it was passed by the Congress, by two-thirds in both houses, passed by the Congress in 1947. So that McCarthyism, because the most active, powerful union leaders in this country, a lot of them were communists, although not all of them. John L. Lewis, who was the leader, most people don't know, at one time there were 400,000 miners, coal miners in this country.
Yeah.
400,000 coal miners in one union.
They were very powerful and certainly left-leaning.
Mine workers led by John L. Lewis.
Yep. So,
and so the decline of the labor movement is traced back to the 1950s. And the labor movement, of course, had been a very, very strong supporter of the Democratic Party when it was the party of the New Deal and the Fair Deal. And, you know, by the time these Johnny-come-lately, no, I shouldn't say that, the later leadership, when Clinton, the Clintons and the Gores and those people came along after McGovern, there was no strong labor movement to oppose them as they took over the Democratic Party.
So was it the case that NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, really was just... I mean, I wonder who was behind that. What interests were directly behind that in steering Gore and Clinton on this? Is it simply a lot of the, it looks to be a lot of the big businesses, the big corporations that just, you know, it's a race to the bottom.
Exactly.
They want to do away with environmental standards and working standards and pay as little as possible.
Yes.
Bill Clinton did that. Bill Clinton did that. So,
yes.
What are some of the effects of the of NAFTA that thank you, Bill Clinton, on the economy as we experience it today?
Well, I think what you're seeing, a very low level of trade union membership among workers, which certainly affects wages. A very low level of government intervention in the economy. One of the other things, nice things that Clinton did was Clinton led the repeal of traditional welfare that we had.
We're going to get to that.
We've had since the Depression.
Yes.
It's you know, I'm amused that the Republican Party is still able to maintain a myth that we have a big welfare system in the United States when it's virtually non-existent.
Well, I want to stick with NAFTA and then get
Okay, so you have the export of jobs. You have the export of capital. Then you have the export of jobs, and they're low wage jobs in the Latin countries, which were part of NAFTA. At the same time, very interestingly enough, and I just happened to read this coincidentally when I was in Mexico City some years ago, and I read the English language newspaper, and there was a Mexican economics professor trained in the United States who wrote a very interesting article about the capital outflow. In Mexico, there was capital inflow that went to a limited number of industries in a limited number of areas of Mexico, like automobiles, for example, or computers or that sort of thing, bleeding jobs out of the United States, at the same time not creating lots of jobs in Mexico. But NAFTA also facilitated the outflow of Mexican capital from Mexico into the United States, not into production in the United States, but into the U.S. stock market.
Oh my!
So that wealthy Mexicans, instead of investing their money at home with the possibility of providing jobs for their people at home, were able to export their capital into the U.S. stock market and make money in the U.S. stock market. Very, very interesting analysis.
Well, that makes me think about the bogeyman that the Republicans are talking about these days, immigration. You know, there's clearly some racism involved there, but there's also, you bring up an interesting point, that if the economy of Mexico and Central America were stronger, there'd be less of a push to come to America.
Oh, absolutely, that was the other point that this professor of economics was making, exactly what you just said.
So then Bill Clinton actually had a lot to do with a lot of the immigration issues that we're facing today, because why should they invest at home when they can get more interest, more money, by investing in the U.S.?
Well, yeah, and you know, what a lot of people don't remember, and certainly what the Republicans don't want you to remember, is that the present immigration policy began under Reagan. And Reagan, coming from California, had a lot of, a certain amount, I don't know how much, of his original support was from wealthy California agricultural interests who wanted to have cheap labor. And cheap labor means labor from south of the Mexican border. So the current situation was originally set up by Reagan. And there was a lot of stuff in the Reagan administration went by the wink and the nod. And so there was a wink and the nod and a nod at the illegal immigration, which with laws that were not enforced, that certainly benefited Reagan's agricultural industry supporters. And we are today, dealing with the legacy of that. I wrote a column on immigration, I forget, several years ago, in which I said that the Republican Party will never agree to any immigration reform, because they lose one of their most powerful electoral interests if they do that. If the immigration problem, quote-unquote, were solved, quote-unquote, the Republicans wouldn't have it to use. And that's why, even when George Bush, nobody except Dick Cheney is all bad.
That's true.
Bush, married to a Mexican, tried to get a reasonable kind of immigration reform passed. His own party wouldn't let that happen because they cannot let go of that issue.
So this issue is partially to blame on Reagan and partially to blame on Clinton. It's it's fascinating to me to think about and to ponder where is the real power? I mean, we talked a little bit about the Glass-Steagall Act, which the repeal of that, it horrified a lot of people that he could do this and take apart and do something that was going to so clearly be so incredibly damaging to the United States, and yet he did it. So the big banks benefited. They could gamble tremendously and get away with it, and it hurt American jobs and the American economy terribly.
I'm sure you know, you've seen the same news item that you know, a lot of other people saw you know, a couple of months ago. I frankly forget where I saw it, but it's generally considered common knowledge. Hillary Clinton is, quote, acceptable, unquote, to the banking industry.
Uh-huh.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I mean, do people really want the big banks? You know, they're such easy targets. Well, understandably, they're easy targets because they serve themselves at the expense of the American economy.
Right, and they're so powerful that, you know, it would be impossible to get Glass-Steagall
reinstated.
Yeah. I think that Elizabeth Warren has called for that, but I'm not sure that she has even called for the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, but I think she has.
Well, I'm guessing Bernie Sanders probably has.
Oh, yeah, Bernie Sanders, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Yeah, in fact, I know Bernie Sanders has.
It just makes me think about, okay, who's in charge here? Where is the power? And how much change did Bill Clinton bring to putting the plutocrats in charge of America? I mean, clearly it's...
Well, you know, Bill Clinton, and you know, it wasn't just Bill Clinton. I mean,
right.
The people that he stood for and a series of Democratic Party politicians, and I'm trying to think of the name of the most prominent Speaker of the House during that, Democratic Speaker during that era, and I can't remember his name. He's from Missouri.
Ooh, I can't think of it either.
Yeah, you know, good-looking blonde guy. If we go back to the New Deal,
I wish we would.
First of all, you may not know this, Bert, but Roosevelt, his true name was not Rosenfeld, and he was not a Jew. you know, and nor was he a socialist.
Of course not. He held off the socialists.
Now, Roosevelt had very strong support in those elements of the U.S. ruling class, the industrialists and so forth, who realized the truth of the statement that Chancellor Bismarck of Prussia made in the 1880s when he introduced into the Reichstag, the parliament, there was a parliament in the Prussian Empire. He introduced the world's first national health insurance program. Most people don't know this. It was limited, but it was the first what led to national health insurance. And when Bismarck's speech to the Reichstag, he said words to the effect of, "The workers are revolting," and he was using that, you know, in two different senses, "but we've got to give them something." And that was Bismarck's argument, that we've got a working class, we have to recognize that we have a working class, and if we don't want them to overthrow us, we've got to give them something. And here's a nice thing we can give them, which was the first elements of national health insurance. Okay. So Roosevelt was not a socialist.
No.
Roosevelt had major elements of the U.S. ruling class behind him.
Absolutely. He saved corporate capitalism.
He saved corporate capitalism, precisely.
No question.
But there were kind of two political representations of the split in the U.S. ruling class, one of which said, we want to keep going gung-ho like we did in the 1920s, you know, under Coolidge and Hoover, and the devil take the hindmost, or if we want to stay in power, we've got to do something for the workers. And so a number of things were accomplished under Roosevelt. We almost had national health insurance under Roosevelt. We almost had it under Truman. I studied when I did my master public health degree, I studied under people who had been very active in this whole thing. And then the Kennedys certainly represented that relatively progressive wing of the U.S. ruling class. Now, what's happened, since McGovern, really, is that the U.S. ruling class has coalesced, and so therefore its political representation has also coalesced. And I think, you know, if there's still historians around 100 years from now, I'm reading Elizabeth Colbert's Sixth Extinction, and I'm wondering, you know, it's not so funny, who's going to be around 100 years from now. But you're going to look back, and you're going to see this kind of coalescence on the economic side in the economically dominant powers. I'm using ruling class as an abbreviation for that.
Sure.
And then the amalgamation at the political level, so that the policies of the Democratic Party are not that much different from the policies of the Republican Party. Now, the Republicans want to make you think that they're tremendously different, and the Republican Party has undergone and is still undergoing day by day what I called and started writing about this about 25 years ago, the rightward imperative of the Republican Party. And that is, their program remains the same. It's reduction of taxes for the rich. It's the export of capital. It's the destruction of American labor. It's the privatization of Social Security, the prevention of national health insurance, and the ACA is anything but national health insurance, and the privatization of anything they can get their hands on, so that they can make profits from formerly, public enterprises. They right now, one of the big targets, as you know very well, is the post office. But they can't, and there's big profits of the banking industry, and of course the preservation of the fossil fuels industry, and so on and so forth. It's very hard for them to run on that stuff. So that's what's responsible for the rightward imperative, that the rhetoric has to be more and more outlandish, and of course they use the religious right.
Well, and that's one thing I wanted to ask. You write that Bill Clinton, through his Attorney General Janet Reno, unwittingly built up the strength and power of religious political extremists. Talk about that, if you will.
Correct. They were right. And in a column, I referred to two aspects of this. One was Waco, which I felt this way from the day one or day two of Waco when it started to appear in the Times. They moved with incredible slowness, and they let Waco expand into what it became, so that the Waco people, this David Koresh, and then of course the religious right rallied around him. They allowed it to become a contest between the federal government and religion, when it should have been, if they'd cracked down right at the beginning, when the United Parcel Service said, and at that point this was illegal, guns are being delivered to these people. There's a violation here, and this has got to be stopped now. And if they had moved very quickly, Waco never would have happened, and a whole lot of innocent young people wouldn't have been burned to death. That Waco was a step up for the organization of the religious right. Now, it wasn't a major step up, I don't think. The major step up for the power of the religious right in this country started again with Ronald Reagan. Reagan came from Hollywood. Okay, he was a right winger. He was a closet informer, actually.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people don't know that. Reagan was an informer for the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But at one time, he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yep.
And he came from a very, you know, liberal culture, and of course abortions happened all the time, and, you know, blah, 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 and homosexuality. I'm sure you're aware, maybe not all of the listeners that are, you know, trivia question. The dominant male macho star, movie star of the 1950s, which macho movie star of the 1950s and 60s, hint, co-starred often with Doris Day, was one of the first Hollywood figures to die of AIDS?
Rock Hudson?
Right.
But it didn't take me that long, but I was getting a little bit worried there.
You were right, but most people don't know this. Rock Hudson was gay.
Yeah, of course.
And Rock Hudson was a promiscuous gay.
So then it sounds like, if I hear you right, Dr. Steve Jonas, that the Republican Party, really what their real agenda is, again, not that different from Bill Clinton's agenda,
right,
and the you know, right-leaning Democrats, is, you know, plutocracy. Let the big corporations just, you know, let them rule. But
absolutely,
a distraction from that is the religious right stuff. The
But they use the religious right. I mean, we have, and so Reagan started this. Reagan,
sure,
brought the religious right into the Republican Party. You may recall that when, after he secured the nomination in the primaries in 1980 for the Republican Party, he turned to his principal rival, George H.W. Bush, and offered him the vice presidency. The condition was that he and Barbara Bush resign from the board of directors of Planned Parenthood of Texas, of which they had been members for years.
Oh, my.
You didn't know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. And so it was Reagan who started this whole thing. You know, Falwell had been working in, you know, this so-called silent majority, but, you know, Nixon didn't really cotton up to these folks.
Right.
You know, he liked having them around, but he didn't bring them into the party. Reagan brought them, brought the Falwells and the Robertsons and all those people into the party. And Reagan was the one who made abortion rights a political issue for the Republican Party.
And so what did, we're talking about Bill Clinton here mostly, what did he do or not do that enabled the continued rise of them?
Well, he didn't fight them. I mean, just, you know, like I mean, like Obama, you know, until very recently, Obama has never really fought back against the Republicans.
Right.
And Bill Clinton didn't fight back against the Republicans. I mean, it was in the early days of the Clinton presidency, I was a supporter of Bill Clinton. In the primaries in 1991, Clinton, and I didn't know who I was going to support in the 92 election. In Clinton's announcement speech in Little Rock for the Democratic nomination for president, he said, he addressed whites and blacks in the United States, and he said, "There are forces in this country which continually put you folks at each other's throats." He didn't use this terminology, but this is what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
"And they divide and conquer. And they prevent you from uniting to fight for your common interests as workers." I mean, he didn't use this rhetoric.
Right.
Okay, but this is what he was saying. And I said, I really like this guy.
Yeah.
I really like this guy. Okay. Never heard it again.
Right.
You never heard it again, you know, that there was this sister soldier thing, and you know, so you never heard this again. But that's what originally attracted me to Clinton. I went down for inauguration in 1993. I'd never been to an inauguration, and it just felt so good.
Yeah.
I went with the wife at the time. I said, I said, it feels so good to finally have a president that I can identify with. Then came the proposal for the Clinton health plan, and I'd been working in health policy for about 20 years at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, this is pretty good. It's not single payer, but it's a big step forward. And if we don't do this kind of thing, what's going to happen is the private insurance industry is going to take over healthcare, which, of course, is what happened. Yeah. And I had some big, I didn't fight, but, I mean, close friends of mine who were single-payer people, sure, turned on me. They physically, in public, turned on me because I was supporting the Clinton health plan. So I was a Clinton guy. I was supporting the Clinton health plan. But one of the things, I don't know whether I said it in this article or not, but one of the things Clinton did a lot of negatives, did a lot of bad things positively, like the NAFTA and pharmaceutical advertising and permanently ending the Fairness Doctrine and the World Trade Organization and the repeal of Glass-Steagall. But he also did not have an organized campaign to get the Clinton health plan into legislation or some version of it. And I was on the inside of that, relatively on the inside. I mean, it wasn't, you know, right, part of the White House staff, but I was part of a group of physicians and other healthcare professionals who were organized to go out and speak at public meetings on behalf of the Clinton health plan. And there was no plan. There was no plan. I was recruited to this essentially by happenstance. I happen to know a lot about healthcare delivery, at least I did at the time. And I went to the first organizational meeting at the White House. Got passes and everything, you know. And you're going into the White House, and you're in a big conference room, and boy, you feel great.
Yeah.
And nothing happened.
Well, do you think it could it have
I,
been?
I came. I, let me hear. I came home, took the train back, maybe I flew back, whatever, came home and said to the then wife, if this is what these people are doing, they're never going to get this passed. And a week or two after that, I came across, and I still have the document, Bill Kristol. Mm. Bill Kristol, he's still an evil person.
Oh, yes.
Evil person with a big smile. Bill Kristol had sent around a fax, and it was so stupid of him to do it this way because, you know, other people saw it. I have a copy of the fax in December, December 1993.
During the healthcare fiasco.
Yeah. Kristol sent around a fax to 1,200 Republican leaders in which he said, we have to defeat the Clinton health plan for political reasons. He was very open about this. He said, because if the Clinton health plan passes, the Democrats are going to be in control of the government indefinitely. And they had this piece of paper.
So...
And they didn't fight. They didn't fight on that. They didn't fight on Whitewater. They didn't. They allowed Clinton allowed his attorney general she appointed Ken Starr. Ken Starr had been a member of the firm, the legal firm, which were the lawyers for Paula Jones, who was the woman who sued Clinton for sexual harassment in when he was governor of Arkansas. Starr had been a member of that firm.
So it sounds like, we got to wrap up here, Dr. Steve Jonas, but it sounds like, if I have this right, Bill Clinton, you know, go along to get along with the ruling elite and just allow it to happen, not really fight for democratic principles. Most of us hoped he would in his second term, as we've hoped that Obama would in his second term. Was that the Clinton presidency? Just sort of smile and let it all happen?
Well, no, I don't agree with that.
Okay.
He let it all happen. He wanted these things to happen because what right-wing Democrats are for. They are supporters with a smiley face of the same, a lot of, not exactly the same, but a lot of the same corporate interests that the Republican Party represents.
Well, maybe some of us Democrats want to change that a little bit. We have an election coming up all the time. And thank you very much for being with us. Very interesting discussion. Dr. Steve Jonas with Buzz Flash at Truth Out. His new book is The 15% Solution, How the Republican Religious Right Took Control of the U.S. 1981 to 2022, a futuristic novel. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Bert.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Bill Clinton, a political man.